And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And I'll say at the top, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And we're on the web, taylor-report.com. And there is Facebook/The Taylor Report. I rarely mention that, but I know the zealots will find a way to get find those sites. And with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
So we hope to be talking to a couple of people today, but one of them for sure is Fred Ziamana, and we'll be talking with him in probably about 10, 15 minutes. But Fred Ziamana is one of the – he's a coordinator of the survivors and victims of the 1972 genocide in Burundi. We often talk on this program about Rwanda. We also talk about Burundi. Burundi is experiencing a political crisis, most of it foreign-sponsored, in that France, United States, and Britain are heading up an effort to remove – their hobby is regime change. When bored, they work to remove somebody's government. Because being democratic countries, they think that's their business. So at any rate, they're very zealous about targeting people, and they have targeted the president, the elected president of Burundi, over what is in fact a internal matter of the nation of Burundi, that is to say the constitutional means of succession, how many terms the president can serve – and all that, Burundi, to its satisfaction, has done that, but not to the satisfaction of Washington, London, and Paris. And they have various followers and associates who help them in this business. So they're challenging the Burundian government and trying to harm it, because the first thing they do is see if they can destroy the economy, prevent elected leaders or members of the government from travel. Freezing their assets, freezing the assets of the country. Anybody who knows anything about Cuba and the U.S. policy towards Cuba, which lasted on and on and on, and actually has not ended. On paper, it's ended, but that's the way the U.S. likes to operate, do a lot of things on paper, and practice is another matter. At any rate, so that's a great concern because, in fact, it's certainly in Canada, they've all bought the leadership here. Has bought into it and is following along with that practice. So we're going to be asking Fred Ziamana about this because, after all, he's a Burundian. He might know something about the country as opposed to editors of the Globe and Mail and the Star. We have other news. Well, Phil, you wanted to tell us you have announced about your program. Phil Conlon is at Classical Undergrounds Wednesdays at 6.
Yes, and we're going to have a very rare treat on this week's program. Maria Rockwall is a historian and a musician who has researched and written a book on the subject of the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra. And you might say, who were they? Well, they were a group of women that, under the leadership of a native of Montreal, Ethel Stark, put together an orchestra in 1940, consisting entirely of women, because at that time, symphony orchestras simply did not permit women to play within their ranks. It was total apartheid, so to speak.
You remember the theory that a woman aboard ship will cause it to sink.
Yes, yes. Well, practitioners of that
theory. Same with
theory.
Mining. Right. If there's a woman in the mine, the mine will collapse.
Terrible things are going to
happen,
right?
Because God works in wondrous ways. Marvels to perform.
Oh, of course. And, of course, we in North America like to criticize what we consider backward attitudes among in other parts of the world. But that backward attitude permeated classical music culture. And this orchestra was a response to it. And we're going to have the author in. And we even have some excerpts of the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra to play for our audience.
By the way, now that was an ongoing effort. There must be women who have... Are there still some women with us who were part of that effort?
It doesn't seem to be. There seem to be only one or two still living, but I mean, the orchestra did close down 50 years ago. And but there are many people who remember it, and it had quite an effect on their lives. You know,
that's a really important one. I hope we return to this many times over, because today in Hollywood, where they're talking about the absence of women producers of films and directors of films. And, of course, it raises yet a second, a third, first question, which is race, because no sooner did Meryl Streep say that, you know, how much she loves this battle, than someone asked her, are you interested in black women? Because they get excluded and they get given certain types of roles. Are you going to do anything about that? And had no answer on that phone call. So anyway, that was – it's Phil Connelly. It's going to be Wednesday. It's
Wednesday
6
at
o'clock.
6. That's right.
And
Classical Underground.
Okay, Classical Underground. And this is the Taylor Report. We're hoping to get a feature on Syria, and we're struggling to do that. We're certainly going to talk about Syria, like right now. I just want to make sure we mention we're getting reports, of course, that the Russian effort there has shown significant advance. And I noticed that the Toronto Star has taken a new tack, and this is opposed to 4 days ago, 5 days ago. Now they have a photograph of Assad, President Assad, and they say that he reports that this progress is happening. It doesn't spend a lot of time laughing at him and saying he has to go and how fed up Canada is. It seems to be just a straight-up report while the editors, you know, drink some black coffee and try to get their brains straightened out as to what's been going on. And certainly all the world's leadership needs to do that. There's some heavy hitting going on at the United Nations. I really urge our listeners, please pay close attention to what is said there. I know that the Russian leadership has said to the British leadership, if you're going to show high dudgeon and an interest in getting going into Syria, then you're going to have to respect the sovereignty of Syria. That you cannot just guns blazing say, oh, because we are upset, we're going to enter another country. This is very important. There are two things about the Russian position. One, it has UN sanction. And two, it has Syria's sanction, which, by the way, two is more important than one. Syria remains sovereign no matter what the United Nations might think. And I would remind you that the People's Republic of China came into existence in 1949, but for the world body, it didn't happen, I think, until 1984. I think that they chose Orwell's years to explain why they'd been so damned ignorant that ignoring 1 billion people might have been kind of stupid. But China remains sovereign by saying, we're sovereign, so don't play with us. And it all worked out rather nicely, actually. And China, too, is upholding these points. What is really bothering the British, and this is where the pinch comes, and they can't avoid it, both the British and the Americans and the French have been operating as though international law doesn't matter and the United Nations doesn't matter. They have not taken any of these big projects of bombing that blazes out of people to anybody. They've just done it. The last time they went to the United Nations and asked for permission, they got permission for a no-fly zone. And then the no-fly zone turned into a NATO fly zone, and NATO then destroyed Libya. Which, if you want, you know, there's always the important dates. If you want to look to a date that really mattered, that was probably one of the big ones, because the next time they asked for permission, everybody just looked at them, as certainly the world did, and Russia for the first. And according to Phil Conlon, we have 5 minutes to go, and I think we're in good shape on that. Now, in the remaining minutes, by the way,
can I just comment that the Globe and Mail ran an editorial about Burundi the other day, which was amazing because they haven't actually run any news stories. And the Globe evidently decided they're experts on the constitutional law of Burundi and that they have it right, along with their friends in Human Rights Watch, and the Burundian court has it wrong. And therefore, we all have to be concerned because never again and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. It was the most arrogant piece you can imagine.
Well, we go from arrogance to arrogance. We have the President of the United States who tells the President of Syria that he has to step down, that he's the problem. And, you know, by the way, I think President Assad's numbers of approval are higher than those of President Obama. I'm impressed with the humility of President Assad and other presidents, other leaders of countries who take this malarkey from the great powers without saying, actually, I'd like you to step down. And I'll give, you know, I mean, because the moment it would be uttered, everyone in the world would faint with, I mean, you can't say that. But it's okay that that someone can define a state as an exceptional state, unlike any on the earth, and then talk to other sovereign leaders as though they are, what is the expression, liver or whatever it is?
Chopped liver.
Chopped liver.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. It's,
the whole world is chopped liver to the empire.
They should do a cartoon. You remember the one you said, New York City, you look at the America and it's just a cactus in San Francisco.
Yes.
Well, the U.S. looks out on the world and it's all just chopped liver. At any rate, it's terribly insulting, and you're quite right. I mean, incidentally, I have no great respect for the American Supreme Court, which gave Bush the election when he lost it. But that's it. The Supreme Court said that. And it's understood that that's a domestic issue and it's not for somebody in another country to announce that the President of the United States has to step down. You know, you're quite right. That goes on. And, of course, I'm sorry to report that our new defense minister, I think it was, made a statement that, again, that Assad had to go. By the way, he obviously hasn't got the word because there's a lot of movement taking place and he'll probably change his line in about a week. But we're in an interesting and stormy situation. I want to point out that at the United Nations, the third committee plenary session on the 11th of November, the 19th, that was Friday, at any rate, 8th Thursday, perhaps, they had a vote once again this year on whether on combating the glorification of Nazism and neo-Nazism and other practices that contribute to fueling contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. The vote was 126 yes, 4 no's, and 53 abstentions. The 126, my goodness, I could list a whole lot of them, but Afghanistan voted for that. Algeria voted for it. El Salvador voted for it. Malaysia voted for it. The Solomon Islands voted for it. South Africa voted for it. South Sudan. Let's talk about the ones who said no. Ukraine, United States, and Canada. By the way, Israel voted for it. But in 1 year, 12 months of hard work by Samantha Powers and other vigorous, highly qualified, brilliant diplomats in the United States. After 1 year of hard work, they pulled a fourth vote into the group, Palau, which I think is about 87 people on a good day, and it belongs to the Americans. That's who they got. That's the four, the mighty four. They would not vote yes on a resolution combating the glorification of Nazism. That's two now. I think we ought to have a three-strike rule. You do that three times and you were definitely out. So that's two strikes. But it is really remarkable. And I wouldn't hurry, by the way some are, to say, I think I know why. It's just somehow domestic politics of Canada. I don't think that's it. It's foreign policy of the United States. And they have, it's true, a loyal friend in Canada, and they can tell you how they got that loyalty, and it's by staring, and after you've been stared at by them, you do what they tell you to do. If you don't, well, of course, they will tell you that you need regime change.